From the Sky News Centre at 6. Theresa May says the UK stands ready to support New Zealand after 49 people were killed in shootings at two mosques in Christchurch. An Australian-born suspect has been charged with murder. Three other people have been arrested. This man was at one of the buildings when the firing started.
I don't know, like, you know, what will happen next, and I don't feel safe here.
Local Mayor Leanne Dalziel says it's unprecedented in the country.
I never could believe that something like this would ever happen in the city of Christchurch. But actually, I would never believe that this would ever happen in New Zealand. And it looks as if something, the worst, has happened, and we need to pull together.
In other news, the DUP says fresh Brexit talks with the government over the so-called Irish border backstop have been constructive.
At the end of the day, some of the concerns that we have been raising are not new. But I think what is new now is that there is a renewed focus in government on ensuring that those issues are addressed.
Deputy Leader Nigel Dodds says progress is being made over the Prime Minister's EU negotiations. They're expected to continue over the weekend as Theresa May battles to build support for her deal. The ringleader of the Hatton Garden jewellery heist has been jailed for 10 years. Michael Seed, known as Basil, was one of two men who climbed into the vault in London in 2015 after breaching the security system. The post office insists improvements have been made following a major League of Beagle victory in an ongoing battle by hundreds of postmasters. More than 550 claim a computer glitch led to the organisation falsely accusing them of crimes such as fraud. A man's been arrested after two children died in a road crash in Wolverhampton. One aged nearly two and another who was 10 were killed when a car hit the vehicle they were travelling in. That's the latest. I'm Will Rowe.
On BCFM 93.2.
He keeps it real, you know what I'm saying?
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Easton, Afzal Shah. Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers is here too. We're also joined this week from Switzerland by filmmaker and activist Marie-Luce Storm. After the 7 o'clock news, 50 dead and another 50 hospitalised by Australian far-right terrorist in Christchurch, New Zealand, although journalists have garnered all sorts of threats, hate and even a crude manifesto from social media. Apparently, the Antipodean Secret Services knew nothing about alleged gunman Renton Tarrant at all. Plus, it's not just Shamima Begum. A phalanx of jihadi brides have now been banned from returning to the UK, even though they were entrapped and groomed online while still children. Who's making these decisions to strip these women of their British citizenship? And why are MI5 and MI6 so afraid for them to return? When hundreds of male fighters have returned without even being interviewed by our police and secret services, despite being trained terrorists. And what about David Cameron's secret memo? Giving our secret services, MI5 and MI6, a licence to kill. So was Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley right when she supposedly misspoke in the Commons, suggesting they really are above the law? After all, she's still in her job. Like a lot of other cabinet ministers that maybe shouldn't be. Also, police criminalised journalists, exposing the horrific Lochan Island loyalist massacre in the Troubles. And we've heard all about the wonders of self-driving cars. Enter the self-driving Boeing 737 MAX 8, the Ethiopian airliner that came down at the weekend. Identical crash to October's Lion Air crash. So what is the so-called stick pusher, which automatically puts a plane into a nosedive, overriding the pilot? Why have Boeing and other authorities been so slow to ground the airliner? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast. from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 and some light rain this weekend. Highs around 11 with some strong winds and rains tomorrow. Light cloud, though, and moderate breeze on Sunday. Highs around 16 Celsius next week. Plenty of sunny spells with some fleeting showers. That's what I like to hear. Next weekend, 23rd and 24th of March, highs around 11 and partly cloudy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour councillor for Eastern Afzal Shah. Hi, Afzal. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Could you take us through some of your roles on the City Council here? You're Eastern Councillor, but you all sit on all sorts of other committees and do other jobs, I imagine.
Yes, I sit on a number of external bodies too. So I'm the Vice Chair of the Resources Scrutiny Committee for Bristol City Council. I sit on the Audit Committee. I'm also a board member for the Bristol for WECA on the Business Advisory Board. WECA, for those of you that trying to work out what the acronym means, is the West of England Combined Authority, which is chaired by Tim Bowles, who is the Metro Mayor.
So why can I just stop you there? Because we have a little bit of an altercation with Tim, trying to persuade him to come in here to talk about bus franchising. He's just refused, simply flat refused, even though he's an elected Metro Mayor for the whole city. He won't sit in the chair where you're sitting and tell us about bus franchising and why he thinks it's so important that we don't do it here in Bristol.
Well, transport is actually one of his remits, and it's really important and one of his responsibilities to ensure that there is debate taking place. And I think it's essential that all politicians, including the Metro Mayor, are scrutinised about the works which they are undertaking. I certainly know in conversations with him that the last time that he appeared on the BCFM Politics Show, he told me that he thoroughly enjoyed it last year, in April, I think.
Oh, well, we weren't asking him about the buses that time. Anyway, you're on audit. I see there's damning reports into Bristol Council Chief's £98,000 payout. Now, that's what people like you are supposed to be keeping a close eye on. This is Anna Klonowski, and your Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, gave her £98,000 of our money that apparently he didn't have to. So that's what's the consequences for something like that?
Well, I think there is learning there, and the local authority accepts that. As per the auditor's findings, that perhaps we could have done things differently.
But I mean, if I was to give someone £98,000 of public money, I'd probably be arrested and put in jail and say, "What do you think you're doing? That's public money. You can't just give it to someone without a good reason."
So I think we have to be clear here. There's absolutely no suggestion whatsoever that any corruption or criminality has actually taken place. And I think that we should also bear in mind that Anna Klonowski, when she did leave, that there were a number of issues regarding care of her parents, one of them of whom was, as I understand it, suffering from a terminal illness. So I think there are issues here about...
Some have called it hush money, haven't they? Say, well, they've given her a lot of big payouts so she doesn't talk about what she was doing while she was here. Is that a bit unkind, do you think?
Certainly, to the best of my knowledge, I think that's pretty unfair, actually, to suggest that it's hush money. I think a lot of consideration was given to the fact that, that one of her close family members was extremely ill and that she actually decided to take some time off to actually be with them. So I think what the local authority would say is that compassion must come first.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, your thoughts on Anna Klonowski and this payout. This is just in this week in the on the BBC. Damning report into Bristol Council's chiefs. £98,000, let's call it £100,000, shall we? £98,000 payout. An auditor's report into the payoff made by Bristol City Council to its former chief executive has been described as damning. Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees insisted Anna Klonowski was entitled to the cash, but the council's auditors said it was inappropriate for the authority to say the payment was contractual. It also found approval for the payment was not sought from the Labour-run Human Resources Committee at all.
Well, I think the problem for Marvin with this is the political problem that it presents. I mean, it doesn't look good, does it, if money's being wrongly spent in this way. But as Afzal said, there's no suggestion here that this is a criminal case. If it was a criminal case, the police would already have taken action on it, and they haven't. It's basically a political decision to spend the money. And, you know, Marvin will have to justify that to the electorate at the next election, won't he?
The police allegedly don't take action on all criminal cases.
Well, they don't, no.
As we've heard with the scandal to do with allegations of fraud at Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit in Castle Park. And there's been quite a lot of allegations of fraud, including by Noel Edmonds. He put up a YouTube film, a Facebook post, etc., about this unit. Now, I know that you're on the what's it called, police committee or something?
So on the police
and crime committee.
So one of my other external commitments is that I sit on the police and crime panel, which holds the Police and Crime Commissioner to account, and I'm also one of the members of the complaint subcommittee that is actually looking into the investigation about the complaints made against the Police and Crime Commissioner for failing to take action in the Lloyds Bank case.
So what are the Police and Crime Powers panel's powers? You're supposed to be investigating this, but can you actually do anything about it? Because there are, I mean, we had a clip with a guy called Trevor Mealham a few weeks ago, who is absolutely insistent that something was done to him called bait and switch. This is where a bank will say, here, we've got a different deal for you here, it's a wonderful deal, and that's the bait. And you go for the bait, you grab the bait, and then all sorts of conditions of your loan get switched. In his case, what he alleges is that he couldn't even get access to the balance of his loan for years. And then eventually Lloyds Bank phoned him up and said, right, well, we're going to have to foreclose on this loan. We're taking all your property, including intellectual property. At which point a legal battle started between himself and Lloyds. Now, he was someone who'd been involved in the past in advising the government on property fraud. So he was actually writing some of the guidance as to, I suppose, what he's talking about really is physical property, buildings. But in his case, he had owned some very, very valuable intellectual property too. So that's the background to the case. What powers do the Police and Crime Panel have?
So whilst we are investigating the complaint, sadly we have no statutory powers to enforce our findings. It is purely an advisory committee. I wholly empathise with all the victims. So there are over 200 victims of the alleged fraud by Lloyds banking staff.
Well, this is the business support unit on Castle Park, isn't it? So everyone knows Castle Park. It's the place that Cromwell blew up after the English Civil War, and it's now a lovely park, and we all like to sit out there and look at the river and the brewery on the other side of the river even. But if you go to the corner of it, you'll find there's still some buildings there, and one of them is this Lloyds Bank building. In fact, it used to be the branch of the Bank of England in the southwest of England, didn't it? And that's where Lloyds Business Support Unit is. It's actually part of National Lloyds Bank. And what Trevor is alleging is that this business support unit was put here in Bristol because there's less likelihood for it to be rigorously investigated by even the Somerset Police. So that's why we're discussing this, because there's all these allegations flying around. So at the end of the day, is it feasible that there will be a further investigation, do you think, into this?
So I think it is pertinent to actually mention that neither the National Crime Agency or the Serious Fraud Office or the City of London Police found any wrongdoing of Lloyds. However, it still beggars belief that when you have the Police and Crime Commissioner from a significantly larger force, i.e. Thames Valley, offering to lend a hand to assist in this investigation, why that was not taken up. And I think that these are some of the questions that we're looking at as a complete subgroup.
Martin, these banks, sometimes I think they think they are above the law. Not necessarily in this case, but they certainly have an extreme, a lot of money, a lot of power, don't they, in today's world?
Well, I think if you think back to the allegations against Royal Bank of Scotland, which we've covered on this show in previous years. When the crisis happened in 2008, the banks basically were desperate to get assets and resources to make themselves solvent, and it's not clear that they are solvent even today if the interest rate goes up. And there's the UN report on drugs and crime, which came out in 2009, mostly written by police officers, made it absolutely clear that the drug cartels just went to the banks in 2008, said, "You need money, don't you? Guess what? We've got loads." And at that point, there was a massive sucking sound.
So
is that
cash you're talking about?
No, they've got loads of
stuff like gold.
We're talking about dirty cash, which of course they do money launder over time through jurisdictions like the City of London, pretending that it's in the Cayman Islands. It's not really in the Cayman Islands, and. All of the banks didn't know what the other banks' assets were, and they knew that they were insolvent. And the criminals at that point took advantage of the situation. But they'd always had a relationship with criminal fraternities, and of course the banking, loads of people should have been sent to prison at that stage, but nobody was, on the principle that
Tom Hayes was, wasn't he?
They're low level, small fry people who have basically been scapegoated. The senior managers should have been sent to prison. That's what should have happened. And in the 1980s, when the savings and loan system collapsed in the US, 1,000 chief executives were sent to prison.
It's well worth looking at the case of Tom Hayes. They called him Rain Man because he was a little bit awkward. Some say nerdy. I don't mean to be unkind by saying that. But he was a very low-level trader, and he's one of the only people to have actually suffered after all of this massive... I mean, some call it, Martin, the biggest heist in history.
Well, it was, wasn't it? I mean, the banking system collapsed, and then the government and the drug cartels bailed it out, and at that point you should have established the authority of the state over the situation. The same thing happens in Switzerland, for example. They're very much involved in all of this dirty business around the world, and this is the reality.
I mean,
something should have been done at that point, and nothing was.
Can you compare this to the showdown between Putin and the oligarchs back in the 2000s?
It's about who's in charge. It's on a bigger scale. Obviously, what happened with Putin and United Russia is they basically disciplined the dirty oligarchy. As the ones that behaved themselves were allowed to go free. We know what you've been doing, but we're just going to turn a blind eye. But if you start making, like Khodorkovsky was about to hand over the Russian oil industry to the Israelis, and at that point the military stepped in and said, "No, you're not doing that." And that was a turning point.
He went to jail for a year, didn't he? But now he's in Switzerland campaigning against Putin.
Yeah, well, Putin released him as a goodwill gesture. There you go. That's what you get for goodwill gestures.
And Berezovsky was another one. He was one of the... Well, they called him the king of the oligarchs. He controlled the first independent TV station in Russia.
NTV.
NTV, yeah. So, and he met his fate in London, didn't he?
Well, he's in Surrey, in his mansion, and of course his daughter believes that he was... The coroner refused to write it off as suicide. So the coroner in Surrey, Berezovsky supposedly strangled himself in his own bathroom. His security guards had gone AWOL for the afternoon and switched the alarms off. And he supposedly strangled himself in his own bathroom. And the coroner refused to accept that it was suicide, although the police and the authorities in Britain were saying it was suicide, suicide, suicide. The coroner refused to accept that it was suicide. And unlike the Skripal case or the Litvinenko case, there was no publicity about the fact that this wasn't a suicide. And that, of course, according to Berezovsky's daughter, is because he was murdered by MI6 and not by the Russians. And, of course, Berezovsky was thinking of making up with Putin. And having worked with MI6 for years, if he went back to Russia, he'd know loads of stuff. And he could tell Putin loads of stuff. So he didn't get back to Russia. And, of course, the police haven't investigated, even though the coroner said it wasn't suicide. So if it wasn't suicide, somebody must have murdered him, but the police haven't bothered to investigate.
Well, someone's got to get their finger out and institute a rule of law around here. Well, we'll see if they do, won't we, Absel? Anyway, look, talking of which, we have this, some call it an epidemic, I would say an increase in knife crime. Do you think that Avon and Somerset Police are equipped to deal with this? I mean, obviously, it's not as bad here, looking at the statistics, as it is in London, but seriously, you know, maybe we can also have a little chat now about what you think the causes of it are, but what are the police actually doing, FSA? Do you know?
So, in the Avon Somerset Constabulary area, we've had a 41% increase in the past 5 years. That is significant. I think out of all 44 constabularies in England and Wales, 42 have seen a significant surge in knife crime. So, it is a problem. I think there is no simple solution. We have to look across the board. I think we have to look at the root causes. Some of these children who are carrying these knives, I think that we have to understand that they are carrying them because they are actually fearful. I mean, so I've spoken to some of them and I've asked them why they carry weapons. You know, when I've spoken to them on places such as Stapleton Road, and they do feel fearful. And I think there's also an element of the area being targeted by County Line's drug gangs. There are dozens of gangs operating in the Bristol and surrounding areas. So I think that this £100 million that's been offered by the Home Office is a drop in the ocean, considering that because of austerity, we've had cuts. Since 2010, we've lost over 20,000 police officers. We've lost over we've lost 652 officers in Bristol in that time.
And although that is, just to put it in perspective, that's 20% of the police force in the country has gone through austerity.
And what I say is, it cannot simply be a case of, you know, that this is a sheer coincidence. And whilst I welcome the fact that Avon and Somerset are looking to recruit another 100 officers in the coming months, it's still a drop in the ocean in terms of all the cutbacks that we've suffered.
Is it an excuse to say I feel fearful to carry a knife?
Absolutely, there is no excuse. It is criminality.
But I mean, what about lack of policing? I mean, if there were more, surely if there were police walking around, people wouldn't feel fearful.
So I think policing is important. I think education. I think it starts those conversations start in the homes. We've also seen the decimation of youth provision. You know, there's. When I was growing up, there was a lot of youth clubs, few and far between now, and I think that we have to look across the board. I organised a meeting with all of Bristol's major sporting organisations last week to see how we could use sporting interventions to tackle some of this youth antisocial behaviour and local crime. So there are a number of activities which we hope to actually take forward.
I'm going to run through a few of my thoughts on this because I think it's such a biggie. There's so much feeds into this, and often we don't hear about some of the things which do cause knife crime. First of all, there's an increase in basically in organised crime in gangs, which is largely caused just by poverty, basically by people being cut off of benefits, by not having any money. So they're instantly, I mean, they need that money to feed the kids, to pay the rent, the bills, the council tax bills, by the way. We nearly were in a situation here where people were going to have to find £1,000 from nowhere to pay the council, and now where are they going to find that? From drug dealing, and that's the easiest and most obvious way to have it.
Well, if I can come in there, Tony, so what I would say is that a little bit unfair because we have got the council tax reduction scheme.
Yeah, but there was a proposal to scrap that, wasn't there, from the mayor, which has been overturned, thank God. But, you know, that's the sort of situation people are in, all this pressure to find money. So there's also, this is a controversial one, gangsterism by the state. I mean, this is a trickle-down effect, isn't it? In Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, you know, we've seen the state behaving like a bunch of gangsters. So it's not surprising when kids copy it. Also, Osborne, George Osborne, when he was Chancellor, included drug dealing and prostitution in the GDP figures. So he's saying, well, actually, this is good for gross domestic product. The more drug dealing and the more prostitution we have, this will up Britain's gross domestic product, and we can make the economy look as if it's doing better than it really is. He did that about 4 years ago. And also, there's also violent video games everywhere. A feeling of powerlessness amongst social unemployed media. Young people, who the games give young men a feeling of power, so they play the games. Obviously, we just talked about police numbers. Also, we've got a very large drug-taking population in the UK, so a market for the organised crime. We've also got almost like ghetto-like immigrant areas, which are very poor areas, where there's a lot of exploitation and unemployment, where capitalism has failed. But nobody knows what to do. And we had a Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, saying that a completely new system needs to be brought in. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this? And do you think there are any solutions?
Well, I mean, you've covered, you've made a number of statements there about various things. I think I've always been in favour of legalisation of drugs because, of course, the drugs industry underpins the banking system. It's and people in Mexico, I went to a trade union delegation to Colombia in 2005, and the dogs in the street know that the banks are basically cooperating with the drug cartels, and they're all cooperating with the CIA. So Pablo Escobar's son gave an interview in Colombia about 6 months ago saying, well, everybody knows my dad worked with the CIA, don't they? I wonder if Theresa May knows. I wonder if George Osborne knows. And of course, you know, this
Barry
is...
Barry Seal, I think. Well, another one.
Yeah, anyway, this has been going back for years. I think, on the specific point of the knife crime, I don't think it is directly related to that, because organised crime is organised, and a lot of this stuff is disorganised, and that's why it's so difficult for everybody to deal with. If you know, to stab somebody is pretty easy. Yeah.
There's a report. Marie, I'd be really interested in your view on this, if you can compare the differences you've seen in Switzerland, in France, and here, and the sorts of things that you see that might increase knife crime. It's always useful to get an international perspective on what we do here, I think. But one thing I would say, picking up on what Martin is saying, he says, I was looking at a recent survey. Marijuana is safer than alcohol, tobacco, or sugar. Well, that's not actually me making that statement. It's Americans say in a new poll published by Tom Angle in some publication in the US. I can't see what that's called. But anyway, Americans think marijuana is less dangerous than alcohol, tobacco, or sugar, according to a new NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. When asked in a survey which substance is most harmful to health, 41% chose tobacco, 24% said alcohol, and 21% flagged sugar. Just 9% believe cannabis is the most dangerous of four options. So that's a survey from the US, a recent survey. Marie, what's your perspective on what you think might be causing this sort of kids to carry knives in a city like Bristol?
Well, I quite agree with what you said.
Absent.
Because education is one of the main lead for to solve the problem. But, to my knowledge, this is quite stable. There is no rise in knife criminal crimes in Switzerland. But there's also no cuts in the police budget for years now. And there is also a disconnection between the white-collar criminality in banks and the street crimes. There is a huge disconnection between that. That doesn't mean that people are not poor and they're struggling sometimes to pay the bills, but there is another way to deal with that. Because if you have to pay your taxes, for example, and you really can't, you can go and tell them, okay, I come this month, and, you know, they find arrangements. Because this is such a rich state that they can just, talk to the people and find arrangements. But education is one of the lead, of course, as for me. To train the young people to resist to the gangs and to have power upon their own lives instead of thinking that having a knife or a gun is having a kind of power.
Well, look, I'll tell you what, let's go to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, because this whole issue actually came up in the Houses of Parliament. I mean, everyone's talking about Brexit all the time. We will, I'm afraid, as well. But occasionally on Prime Minister's questions, we get back to the real world.
Rosie Duffield!
Speaker. On Friday, some of the excellent head teachers in my constituency sent letters home with their pupils, detailing to parents how their budgets have been slashed by 8% and they're struggling to make ends meet. They've asked on three separate occasions since September 2018 for a meeting with the Secretary of State for Education to discuss school shortages in Kent, and have been refused. So can the Prime Minister please ask him to meet with Ms Spinks, Ms Hind, Mr Wright, Mr Cooper, Ms Butcher, Ms Nope, Mr Pywell and others as a matter of urgency?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
Well, I'm sure I will ensure that ministers in the Department for Education have heard the request that the Honourable Lady has put forward. But just to remind her and members of this House, the school's budget this year is £42 billion. That is the highest school budget ever.
Order! Order!
dare?
The school's budget is the highest ever this year, and we've given every local authority more money for every pupil in every school this year.
Well, she didn't say she'd meet the teachers, Martin Summers. She said, oh, well, the Department for Education have heard the request.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that there has been cuts in school budgets, but one of the key things which most people fail to recognise is special needs children, who are the most vulnerable, are the top-up funding for them, even in academy schools like the one I'm working in at the minute, comes from the local authorities. And the local authorities' budgets have been definitely cut. The government's got no...
You've been in and out of education for years. How is it getting on these days?
Well, I won't talk about particular individuals, but the case of at the moment, I'm working with a young boy, and the school is having to find resources to deal with his behaviour, and they've applied for extra funding from the local authority, but the local authority, of course, is cash-strapped. I mean, it's not just the money spent on schools. The money for special educational needs comes via the local authority, because, of course, all of this used to be run by local authorities. And, of course, the other thing about the education budget is the creation of academy schools. The top bosses of academy chains earn private sector salaries. In the past, the chief of education for a local education authority was a public servant, and there was a definite ceiling on what they earned.
But I can remember last year, I think it was, we learnt AFSAL that there's 1,000 less teachers in Bristol. The pips are starting to squeak, aren't they, in our schools?
They absolutely are. You only have to walk just a few metres from here into City Academy, and I was talking to the facilities manager and asking for some kind of consideration to be made for community groups who want to hire the hall out, and effectively they're having to use whatever money they have to subsidise teaching in the school, and that is actually put back into that school. Teachers will tell you this up and down the country, that they just cannot take this anymore. And those that are hit particularly badly are those with special educational needs and those who are the most vulnerable. And when we talk about issues such as knife crime, schools are imperative. They are part of the solution. And if they aren't given those resources to actually tackle this, then you're going to... It's actually a false economy.
There's something... Marie. There's something a bit perverse about this. It's like the most vulnerable people are the ones to get hit. So if you're weak, it's almost like the law of the jungle.
Yeah, and it makes me think that, sadly enough, when they start, the government, any kind of government, start to cut the budget of education, then a few years after, we can see the whole, you know, the whole story starting again. I mean, the kids are not really properly educated, and there's no teacher to really take care and accompany them, and then they're left alone, and the most vulnerable as well, because it's also they have special needs, and families need some people, trained people, to accompany them. So I think that it's the first step for a situation that will degenerate into something like knife crime and things like that.
Mark Martin, survivor of the fittest now, is that what we're looking at?
Well, yeah, but as AFSAL and Marie have both suggested, this is a false economy, because ultimately, of course, you then have to spend money on prisons, police officers and so on. And what is the price of a human life of some child who could have been some of the kids who are getting caught up in this, like they could have been, you know, university graduates, they could have contributed, but of course if they're stabbed dead when they're at 15 years old, then they can't, can they? And of course it's a long term thing. We've been cutting state education for years, and of course, well, after 15, 20 years, this is what
Theresa
you get.
May has announced lots more money apparently for cities, there is, I think this is, yeah, this is was on The Week in Westminster last weekend on the BBC, and Sam Coates talks to the MP Lisa Nandy about the £1.6 billion which is being spent in cities, and the only trouble is it doesn't look as if it's going to find its way into our schools. So let's have a listen to that now.
Cash for deprived towns, designed to woo Labour MPs, disappointed many.
We spoke to Labour MP Lisa Nandy about the £1.6 billion Deprived Towns Fund announced on Monday. Lisa, when the news emerged last Sunday at about 6 o'clock, you issued a statement giving it a cautious welcome. By 11:30 on Twitter, you were saying that you were deeply frustrated. What do you think about what's happened, and does it deliver what you wanted?
The reason I was so deeply frustrated last Sunday is because, like Andrew said, you know, lots of us have been saying for a long time that this city-centric model we've got is not delivering for our towns. And finally, there was a recognition of that. But then within a few hours, this announcement started to unravel, so at first it was billed as 1.6 billion, but then it became apparent that was over 6 years. Then we found out that the money was being allocated through local enterprise partnerships, which are based in cities, which largely speak for cities that don't understand our towns. So same old, same old. And the most frustrating thing about it was that it ended up being presented, because of the way they timed it, as a Brexit bribe. So instead of having a really positive conversation about how we could rebuild our towns, we ended up having a row about whether people's votes could be bought.
So how should this money be spent?
Well, the way to ensure that the money is spent on the right things is actually to make sure that those communities are in the driving seat of how the money is spent. We don't just want funding, we want real power. And at the moment, we've got a very city-based model of decision-making, so that most of our transport decisions are made either in Manchester, which is the nearest city to me, or in London. And it means that the surrounding towns always lose out.
But where are you suggesting the money goes? If not these local enterprise partnerships, where should it go?
Well, there are, funnily enough, some accountable bodies in our towns, known as councils, which tend to be far more connected to and responsive to the demands of the community. High Streets is a really good example. My High Street 10 years ago was thriving. Now we've got lots of moneylenders, we've got lots of charity shops down the bottom end of the High Street. The plan is to try and turn a lot of that into housing, and that's a plan that is largely being driven by national government. But if you listen to local people, what they say is, no, we do want high streets, we do want town centres, and so the council is trying to push back very hard against that and make sure that we still have shops and restaurants and cafes so that people can come and be connected in those areas.
Well, that's Labour MP Lisa Nandy there talking about, it started off as a 1.6 billion cash for cities and towns, then we realised actually it's only going to be 3 billion really, because it's spread over 6 years, and actually it's going to the local enterprise partnerships, AFSAL, rather than the council. So what are these local enterprise partnerships?
These local enterprise partnerships they're extremely unaccountable. You have people in there of significant influence from private bodies, essentially, from big business. But also,
I know on our LEP round here, we've got people like Western College, but a lot of them are sort of what used to be national infrastructure run by the councils and run by the government, which has now been privatised. So, but they're actually spending this money in their own interest, effectively, aren't they?
Yes, and I should say that I think Steve West is the chair of the local LEP. I've not met Steve, but I'm sure he's quite an affable individual. At least he's from the University of West of England. But the problem I have is that I don't know any local organisation, I don't know any businesses in this area that have benefited from the LEP whatsoever, and certainly not in the inner city part of Bristol. So I challenge anybody that if you have received any funding from them, please come forward and let me know, because I've yet to find out of a single
These
pound spent locally.
These sound a little bit like the old regional development agencies.
They are, essentially.
Yeah. Martin, this local enterprise partnership's getting this money, not the council.
Yeah, because local government in this country has been systematically dismantled since the 1980s. And it's pretty laughable to find that, you know, what it sounds like a lot of money, £1.5 billion, but in the big scheme of things, that's peanuts. And of course, you know, in Knowle in Liverpool, they've lost something like £240 per head in central government cuts in their funding.
Sorry, it's £300 million a year. It's announced to begin with.
That sounds like a lot of money, but in terms of the what we're talking about, it's nothing. In other words, it's just window dressing. And of course, the government have been fiddling with the standard spending assessments, and most money spent in poor parts of Britain isn't raised by council tax locally. It comes from the central government as on a formula. And they've been rigging the formula ruthlessly so that East Dorset, which has the highest GNP per capita in the country, has had the lowest cuts in its local services, whereas Knowle in Liverpool, which is probably one of the most deprived communities in the country, has had the biggest cuts. And then we wonder why we're getting knife crime and all the rest of it. It's just because it's class war from the top. And that's what's been going on for 30 years in this country.
And they've also, just if I can add in there, so Bristol is one of the pilot areas, one of the first pilot areas actually in the UK for 100% retention of business rate relief. And whilst they keep cutting back on the central grant which we receive, they're just saying, right, you can increase more funding from local taxation in terms of putting that burden on local businesses and on local residents, but they want to still continue taking more and more from people. And as I've said before, it's a case of cutting away, but smoke and mirrors. They know that that eventually people will find out these figures are peanuts. Just as you said, absolute peanuts. I mean,
£300 million isn't peanuts, is it?
It actually is. I mean,
in terms of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about £300 million, we're talking about as a region. So we're not talking about Bristol, and it's over a number of years, and then that will go into certain sectors, and then we also have to look at accountability in terms of who is responsible for spending this. Where is it ending up? So if you look at academies, academies is another very shady area in terms of PFI and everything. That's not benefiting the local communities which they serve. So I think it's very important to see where this.
I noticed, for example, the LEP used their funding to buy up the Winter Gardens and refurbish it for the use of Western College, or at least, you know, that's for their use. So they're using this money, it seems to me, the LEPs, just purely to help what is effectively now private, farmed out businesses from the government. Anyway, let's go to Brexit, because it's been a big week in all sorts of votes. Quite what all those votes really mean is another question entirely. But let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, because it's fascinating to see whether the Labour Party have actually got a policy, because they seem to be very good at criticising but not actually coming up with much. So let's have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions now.
I absolutely concur with the Prime Minister's remarks about the disaster of the air crash in Ethiopia, and indeed the earlier crash in Asia that affected the same aircraft. And could I also at this point commend the Civil Aviation Authority and the European Union for taking prompt action about the safety of the aircraft concerned.
The British did it, and then the EU followed, by the way.
All air passengers as safe as they possibly can be. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister has been stubbornly declaring that the only choice is between her deal and no deal. Last night's vote finished off her deal. Tonight, she's not even showing the leadership to whip on no deal. Just a few weeks ago, the Prime Minister whipped her MPs against ruling out no deal. So how will she be voting tonight?
The Prime Minister!
I'll be voting for the motion standing in my name.
Well, that was her only answer. So there was an actual vote on this whole, whether to rule out a no deal, wasn't there?
Yeah, but it doesn't have binding force. So in theory, we could get to the end of the process and still have no deal. Although the decision to go back to the EU and ask for an extension looks, I mean, the Prime Minister is behind that. She wants an extension. And so we now move into a different kind of negotiation.
But for me, one of the most interesting votes was this one about whether the government or Parliament should be in control. And it was an extremely narrow vote
two
as well.
Votes.
So
votes.
Let's have a listen to the announcement of that now.
The ayes to the right, 312. The noes to the left, 314.
The ayes to the right, 312. The noes to the left, 314. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock.
Well, this marvellously archaic system that we have of nose to the left or whatever that means, you know, I don't know if they're looking over to the left or something. But anyway, so Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, this is really a very, very narrow defeat. But I mean, again, there are all sorts of questions about whether these votes have actually really any effect. Aren't parliamentarians kidding themselves that they think that they're, even when they're voting to take control and failing there, that they can have any effect on what happens?
Well, I think the in theory, the executive, the government, is answerable to Parliament. I mean, we had a civil war about all this stuff, if you remember, in the 1640s. So this is probably, you know, all of these constitutional issues are coming to a head, including the question of the, you know, Irish unity and all the rest of it. I mean, this is a big constitutional crisis. But I think, you know, what's happening is that, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. If this was a match in the World Cup, it would be a fantastic game of football, and we could all be cheering our teams, and we wouldn't care who won because it would be a brilliant match. Because there's so many things going on, and there's so much happening. But in actual fact, in the real world, it's a nightmare.
I can see people like Robert Peston actually coming to life for the first time. It's a real, genuine political drama that's playing
out. Oh, it is. It's an extraordinary crisis.
Rather than them just trotting out press releases day after day after day, suddenly they've got a job to do. So let's have a listen to now to the fact that there may be a no deal, and is there going to be any money to make sure a no deal can actually work?
Shailesh Bara.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given that no deal Brexit is the government's default position, will the Prime Minister kindly inform the House that she will instruct the Chancellor of the Exchequer to make available whatever funds are required to ensure that the country is as best prepared as possible in the event that we do leave on a no-deal basis?
Can I say to my right honourable friend, obviously we continue to be working to leave in an orderly fashion with a deal, but we have made funding available. That funding is being used to ensure that we have preparations for a no-deal.
Yes, she always seems to lose her voice at the crucial times when important things are happening for some reason. Anyway, what do you make of it? Can you explain Brexit to us?
Well, so we've got less than 2 weeks left. March the 29th, 11 p.m. It seemed like we are due to actually leave the European Union.
So
however,
will we? Do you think?
Well, I mean, the thing is everything going to turn as was expected with the Y2K chip? You know, are the lifts going to stop? Are the computers going to switch off? Is Heathrow Airport, you know, going to go into meltdown? No, I don't think so. However, we can see that Theresa May is hanging on, and what I mean hanging on, it just could not get any worse. And you were just saying about Jeremy Corbyn. Well, actually, Jeremy Corbyn has shown leadership on this. And one thing that the Labour Party have been very frank about is that we will not, in any way, shape or form, accept a no-deal Brexit. Businesses up and down the country, the worst thing for them is uncertainty. And we can see also levels of hate crime, so there's a lot of concern out there.
But hang on, because businesses didn't vote for what it was. The vote
they don't,
was not
but
given
they do
to
provide
the
jobs.
Yeah, but it wasn't their vote, and the people decided that they wanted to leave. And if the EU is going to be awkward, then we may have to leave with a no deal, surely.
Is it not important that we take into consideration what businesses think? I mean, ultimately, businesses provide jobs. They provide prosperity to this country too. And we're not just talking about big business. We're talking about small businesses as well. And there's a number of businesses that I know who are very concerned about, you know, the exports that they have to Europe.
Okay, so an extension? Are we going to get an extension?
We will definitely get an extension, of course.
Well, that's not what, I hate to disappoint you, that's not what Guy Verhofstadt is saying. He's one of the top, what is he exactly? I'm not actually even sure. He's the president of the ALDE group in the EU and Brexit coordinator for the European Parliament. He says under no circumstances will there be an extension unless there is a clear majority in the House of Commons for something precise. There is no reason at all for the European Council to agree on a prolongation. Even the motion tabled for this evening by the UK government recognises this. That's what Guy Verhofstadt says. Also, we've got there's all sorts on this topic, but then there is the fact that you've got to get everybody on board at the European Council. anybody can veto this extension. So the Italians, for example, have said that they may say, well, we're going to veto it to help the Brits out so that they can leave, because we support the British people rather than the Parliament.
Well, you could say the same about the Spaniards in terms of Gibraltar, the Rock of Gibraltar. It is a period of uncertainty.
There seems to be a lot of delusion around. People that think that everything's going to be fine. Like, we've got the third vote, apparently, next week on this deal of Theresa May.
What I'm hopeful for is Monday morning that we have some good news that Theresa May resigns and an election follows. I do feel that we need solid, good governance. The Labour Party are very clear that we will not tolerate a no-deal Brexit. And I think it's important to actually bear in mind that there's a lot of disinformation from the Leave camp.
Surely both. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to say one side was being given. Anyway, Martin,
millions of pounds of illegal spending.
What do you make of this idea that the EU Council might just veto an extension?
Well, I understand that Donald Tusk is saying that we're not going to give... You see, don't forget, if we get an extension to June 30th, then we'll have to participate in the May European elections. And the government are mandated to ask for that, and the Prime Minister is going to ask for it. And I understand that the discussions in the European Commission are, well, we're not going to give you just a short gap like that, because we'll just end up in the same position we were in 3 weeks before. We're going to give you a year and a half.
A no Brexit, and that might mean...
A year and a half, yeah, to sort yourself out.
Well, that might mean a second referendum.
Well, it would probably
be
a second referendum.
Completely
or a general election.
That completely... I was amazed, actually, watching BBC Question Time last night. They were talking about this second referendum. They didn't mention there'd been a vote in the House of Commons, which was an overwhelmingly rejected...
Let me come back to that. That was put forward by this new independent grouping, and, of course, they hadn't cleared it with the Labour Party leadership. The Labour Party leadership will whip their people to support a second referendum if it's the last thing standing. This is like a game of poker.
Talking about the independent group, just quickly, I was amazed to see Chukwuemeka saying, who's the leader of this group apparently, bring back national service. I mean, is that a normal Labour Party policy, Afzal Shah?
I should add that Chukwuemeka is no longer a member of the Labour Party.
No, I'm sorry, yeah, but he's free. He's saying all sorts of... Anyway, I really should ask you, Marie, what you make of this as a Swiss person looking at this. Now, actually, the Swiss are not in the European Union, are they? So
yeah.
What do you make of all of this?
You know, that's interesting, because for the last 20 years, there were two votations in Switzerland. And
it's like a referendum type.
No, that was that was not a referendum. In Switzerland, a referendum is coming from the people. That was the government saying to the people, okay, do you want to be in the EU or not? And twice, in the first place, people were saying no. Swiss people said no, clearly. So that's pretty clear. And the thing is, from our perspective, I mean, the phrase, this will be Theresa May deal or no deal, sounds really like a kind of joke in a way, but makes people feel like there shouldn't be an extension. I mean, if British people can't make up their mind by now, it's not an extension that will help. They will continue to fight, they will continue to debate, and in 2 years' time they might just be at the same point. That's
well,
what we think.
Why do you think that the Swiss voted so, and twice, against the EU?
Mm, yeah.
What do you think was in most Swiss people's minds?
You know, the Swiss government have what they call the bilateral treaties with the countries around, so France and...
Basically in the single market.
Yeah, exactly. And also because, you know, monopoly is not illegal in Switzerland, so, or they have ways to deal with that for big companies and even for smaller businesses. So being in EU would really question the economy in Switzerland, and they don't want that. And I think they're doing well their way, so they don't want to change that.
You've got a few problems there, haven't you? You've got things like zero... Or is it negative interest rates in Switzerland? So if you put your money in the bank, you'll find that next year there's a few pennies missing and the bank has taken it.
Yeah.
So that's not really what people want. It doesn't encourage people to save, does it?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Right.
I mean, just generally speaking, though, you don't have the same sort of problems we've got with austerity.
True.
Martin, why is that, do you think?
Well, they've got all this dirty money from all over the world flowing through their banks. Yeah, and the whole thing about the banks, banks are underlying all of this.
Surely the Swiss,
all of these debates, you should be talking about the banking system, surely, and instead we're talking about Brexit.
Surely UBS and Barclays are actually in the same ballpark here. Is there a connection between what's going on in the Swiss banking system and here in London?
Well, it's all linked. It's all interlinked. And Switzerland and Norway are in customs agreements with the EU. So they're not in the EU politically, but economically they're totally integrated. And of course, the row here is the right wing of the Tory party don't even want to be in a customs union, which then causes a hard border in Ireland, which then starts a constitutional crisis going and so on. If they were happy to be out of the European Union politically, but still in it economically, the common market, then we wouldn't have a problem. But they're not prepared to do that. They want to go the whole hog. They want a no-deal Brexit. And if they get it, of course, the economy will crash. Well, and those who say otherwise will find out.
As we were hearing earlier, lots and lots of young people finding it difficult to get work, difficult to find jobs, difficult to believe in the system that they're born into. But it's also pensioners who are being hit. In state pensions last week, we heard that thousands of the poorest pensioners will lose out. The government reveals that partners of working age will no longer be able to claim pension credits. The government's revealed 60,000 of the least well-off pensioners with partners of working age are set to lose thousands of pounds a year as a result of benefit changes designed to save £1 billion over the next 3 years. Now, it just sounds almost like we're being fleeced left, right and centre. Final item, though, is the suspension of Lord Steele from the Liberal Party. I don't know if you've seen this story, Martin, over his lack of action over Cyril Smith.
Well, what's extraordinary about that, he interviewed Cyril Smith years ago, and Cyril Smith admitted to him that he was abusing young boys, and David Steele's defence was that I didn't take any action about it, because at that stage he was a Labour councillor. But when he joined the Liberal Democrats, he knew that Cyril Smith was a paedophile, but he didn't do anything about it, which is why he's been suspended. And he knew all along. And he said his defence is, well, he was a member of the Labour Party, so it was nothing to do with me. It's like, hang on a minute.
This reeks of a cover-up, and as I've always said, that when we talk about the narrative around child sexual exploitation, this goes right to the heart of the establishment. And I think it's important that those files that we are supposed to have, or which may still exist hidden away in the archive rooms, that we need access to them, and there needs to be investigations. People need to be prosecuted. Those individuals who are still in the corridors of power need to be brought to justice too.
Okay. So, time now for the US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our... Oh, by the way, Lord Steele also nominated Cyril Smith for a knighthood. Thanks to our guest, Labour Councillor for Eastern Efteling. Sorry, we'll be staying just for a bit. And also to Martin Summers and Ray Storm, who will be joining us after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.